Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Most of us live with a sense that it can't happen to us, that we are smart enough and savvy enough to keep our lives in order, and that's a good thing. But as we all know as well, sometimes things get skewed, sometimes they don't go as planned, and we find ourselves confronted with the realization that we now need to do the right thing to survive. I hope each of you has gotten far enough away into the wild and have had that moment when you feel, even if just for a split second, that you've lost your bearings. We take the next two segments to tell you what you need to know with a lesson in survival. Stay tuned. Oftentimes in the news, when we hear of a particular event that captures the attention of the nation and sometimes the world, it's a great time to use that as a moment for learning. And certainly the story of a young 12-year-old Boy Scout who was off with his family and friends in a church group in North Carolina in the mountains, and for various reasons wandered away and then was lost for 4 days. It's a great time to really think about what that means. He was very fortunate. He was found alive. But if it weren't for groups like Search and Rescue, which are scattered all around the country, there's a chance that he may not have made it back. The Search and Rescue provides terrific service at times like this of extremely dedicated people and their dogs and friends and associates. The Search and Rescue workers have saved many, many, probably thousands of lives throughout their history. Well, now joining us to talk about what Search and Rescue does, and also what people need to know if they find themselves in this situation, is Howard Paul, who is joining us now from Colorado. Howard, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you very much.
First of all, let's talk about the group that you're representing today, the National Association of Search and Rescue.
NASAR has been around since the 1970s, and it is, if you will, the professional association for people in the field. From across the nation and from other countries as well.
Mm-hmm. And how about a website so the people who want to may be able to follow along as you talk?
Certainly, that's www.nasar.org. Very simple.
Now, you're the president as well of the Colorado Search and Rescue Organization. How long have you been involved in Search and Rescue?
I became involved myself here in Colorado in Search and Rescue back in 1985. Seems like quite a long time ago.
What brought you to it?
It was interesting. I had been recruited to join a team and declined, didn't really see any interest in it. But a few years later, decided to take that same team's training class in order to become a little more self-sufficient, be able to take care of myself when I was back skiing, hiking, that sort of thing. And it just sort of got in my blood and stuck.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does take a lot of training and coordination to effectively administer a search and rescue experience. What do people have to know before they head out on these challenges to locate someone who literally their lives are on the line?
Well, it's going to vary somewhat from region to region, and that typically would depend upon the weather and the topography. For example, the Adirondack Mountains will require different skills than the deserts of New Mexico, which require different skills than the high alpine peaks of Colorado or Washington. But typically, the person that does the best in search and rescue is someone that's very outdoors-oriented themselves. And that could just be from a recreational start, someone that's a hiker, a backpacker, a camper, a backcountry skier, or a climber, something along those lines. Most organizations have training programs of their own that they'll put you through. The National Association for Search and Rescue has training curricula that have been created by committee over the years and can lead to certifications that many teams or county sheriffs will use to ensure that all of their folks are properly trained.
Now, in your time working actually on search and rescue operations, how often are you called out?
That can vary greatly as well. There are some areas where a team might have 10 or 12 calls a year. There are others that might have more than 100 calls a year.
Wow.
And that depends greatly just upon the size of the community, the location, are a lot of tourists drawn into that community during the summertime? Is it a big draw for winter recreationalists? Smaller rural or even frontier counties might be in that 10 to 12 category. If you're in an area that is extraordinarily popular for hikers or perhaps for technical climbers, such as Yosemite or the climbing areas outside Boulder, Colorado, you could be well up into the 100s a year.
Mm-hmm. And I think most of the people who are involved are doing this on a voluntary basis.
That's true. Most of the professionals providing that service, search and rescue across the nation, about 90% of them, are what we call unpaid professionals. They're giving of their time at no cost to anyone.
Well, it's an extraordinary service that you render. Let's talk about what are kind of the common ways in which people find themselves in need of your services.
Well, I think there are a couple of different things. One is perhaps just not quite paying attention as well as they should. And the second thing that's sort of related to that as well is even when you're paying attention, it is extremely easy to miss a trail junction or miss a trail sign. Literally, if you could be walking down a trail, approaching a trail junction, and something will distract you, perhaps the noise of an animal, even just a bird chirping off to one side. You look to the side as you're walking, and you've missed the trail junction because it's not very clear. You can't quite tell that you should have taken a switch back to the right. There's a little bit of a lesser trail leading straight on, and it's before you realize it, you're off the trail completely.
Well, and of course, if you're following some sort of topo map or some other map, it's extremely easy, as you say, to miss a fork because they may not be marked, and then all of a sudden you find yourself basically on the map somewhere, but you really have lost your orientation, and it's at a time like that, you may not know where you are on that map, is where the trouble begins.
Mm-hmm. That's very true. It can be a sudden realization, or it can be sort of a creeping realization that something doesn't seem right, or, you know, the stream I thought was going to be on my left, and now it's on the right. Something's wrong.
Right.
Either land is wrong, the map is wrong, or I'm wrong.
Right.
Odds are I'm wrong, not the land wrong, or the map being wrong.
Unless you have some sort of GPS device and you know how to use it, that's where difficulties really begin.
That's very true. Mm-hmm. And, you know, modern technology does a lot of things, but I caution everyone to not use modern technology as sort of your sole tool to get you through. Such things as GPS receivers and cell phones are notorious for failing at the wrong moment or not working out in the backcountry, especially cell phones.
That's a really good point, by the way.
If you're at high altitude, such as Colorado or California or anywhere where your terrain above most of the population, you may be in an area where your cell phone cannot tie into the cell phone system and you can't get a signal.
I hadn't even thought about that, really, but I think there's a lot of people that go out and say, well, that's okay, I've got my cell phone, but you're right.
Yeah.
By the time you think you need it, it's not there. You're in a dead zone.
And boy, panic can set in quickly if cell phone's not available.
You talked about not paying attention. Talk about that, because that's a really great point, too, that people oftentimes find themselves in these situations because they're not paying attention. What does that mean to pay attention?
Well, what does it mean to pay attention? Think ahead. Keep a map in your head of what your intended path is. It doesn't have to be specific. It can be general, as in I'm walking upstream, up this valley, and tending to climb to the left, which will put me on a ridge where I can see my destination. That destination might be a fire lookout tower. That destination might be a shelter hut along the trail, for example, on the Appalachian Trail. It could be a lake that I'm then going to descend to go fishing. Keeping that in mind, if things don't seem to match what you have in your head, that should be a pretty good clue that perhaps you and the lay of the land aren't quite matched up. When we talked about hiking on trails, obviously keeping an eye on a trail, and keeping in mind that trails sometimes for short distances will get overgrown or they might just peter out, you have to look ahead and see where that trail picks up again. The other thing, too, is just a general paying attention of your surroundings. And I'll give you an interesting short story about one of the two times I was lost on a search mission. Now, I'll tell you, I wasn't lost for very long. The first time was for maybe 30 seconds. The second time was maybe for 5 minutes. But that first time, we had been on a search assignment. It was a team of three or four of us. We had been traversing a hillside all morning. Lunchtime came. We decided it was time to stop, take a break, have some lunch, put on some clean socks. And we all sat down and we were eating. And after just a few minutes, we decided it's time to get up and continue our assignment. We all stood up. We all looked around 360 degrees and had no idea which direction we had come from.
Wow.
And we're the trained searchers. Now, it didn't take long to figure it out. We quickly pinpointed ourselves on the map, and this was in the days before GPS, but using the map, using the compass, we could tell exactly where we were. But it was literally just that few minutes of not paying attention. We came in, we decided we're going to take a break, so we switched off our brains, we sat down, relaxed, and then when it was time, we stood up, we switched on our brains, and nothing matched up. So we, technically speaking, we were lost, but we found ourselves pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's that simple.
I know one of the practices that I use all the time, it's some of the best advice I ever learned, I don't know who taught it to me, but that is when you're walking, frequently, turn around and look backwards. So that you see the lay of the land from the perspective that you're going to have to know it if you have to go backwards, as you have to go home, okay, or retrace your trail.
That's very, very true. Not only for folks that are hiking that haven't become lost, we teach that in search and rescue, that when we're searching for people to constantly look behind you, look above, look to the left, look to the right. It's not unheard of that a searcher will have walked past someone or walked past a significant clue, which might be a hat that we have determined belongs to the person we're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very significant clue. We found their hat. They've got to be in this area. But if they had not turned back, they wouldn't have seen it, because approaching it because of the lay of the land, maybe some shading by trees, the direction of the sun, they wouldn't have seen it until they turned around when they were past it. And that really leads me to a good topic about how to not get lost, especially if you're a child like this 12-year-old scout.
Well, go ahead. Why don't we talk about that?
Certainly. There's a great national program called Hug a Tree and Survive, which is sponsored by the National Association for Search and Rescue, that we've been teaching since the late 1970s. It came out of Southern California after a boy went missing and was not found for several days, and was found, he had passed away. He had died, I believe, of hypothermia. And that shook quite a few of the people that were involved quite a bit. And it led to a gentleman named Ab Taylor, who was then a tracker with the Border Patrol, to help set up this program called Hug a Tree and Survive. And it teaches very simple core topics to young kids as young as kindergarten or even younger. It teaches kids to do things such as stay on the trail. It also teaches kids, as you just mentioned, to look behind and recognize a landmark. In the program, in the photographs, in the slides that we use, we show a young boy on the trail. We show him looking over his shoulder and seeing a big mountain that's plainly visible back up the trail, which he could use to return to the trailhead where the camper is if he had thought to turn around and look behind him.
It's amazing, because there's two different worlds. It's the world you're going to and the world you're coming from, you just came from. And they're
right.
Two totally different visions.
And two different visions, and most people are clued in 99.9% on the world you're going to.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think about the world you've come from. It's a great way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
The other things that program teaches, and this is valuable for adults as well, although with kids, obviously, we use language that's keyed into them. Two things are of greatest importance. The number one is hug a tree. We teach kids to hug a tree specifically to keep them in one spot, to stop them from moving. It's much harder to find a moving target. The worst example could be this. Little boy, little girl gets lost. He hugs his tree for a while. Search teams are out looking. The little child decides to move on in hopes of finding someone, finding help. They don't even realize someone's looking for them, perhaps, other than their family. So they leave their tree and they move on. Guess what happens? After they leave their tree, the search team walks right past where that child had been. And the child has now walked into an area that has already been searched earlier that same day and might not be researched for 2 or 3 days. So that's why we want everyone, young child, even adults, stay put, let searchers come to you. And to help those searchers come to you, we want you, if you're lost, to do some things to attract them to you. For the little kids in Hug-A-Tree, we call that making yourself big. But the principles are the same with an adult. Make noise. You want to have bright colors. Obviously, if you're wearing a bright colored jacket or hat or gloves, they're going to be seen from a much greater distance than someone that's wearing blue jeans and a khaki shirt or an olive drab hat, which blends in nicely. One of the things that we teach every little kid is to carry a whistle around their neck, because it can carry, the sound carries so much farther, especially at night. And yes, we do search at night. Many people don't understand that we do. Search is an emergency. We've got to find someone before they have the opportunity to travel too far. So we do search at night. As a matter of fact, as far as my team is concerned, the majority of our searches start at night. We get that phone call for someone that hasn't returned at 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock at night. And we're out in the dark searching. There's an advantage that sound carries better in the dark. I don't know why, but it does. And it's very advantageous.
Maybe there's less ambient noise from creatures and different things. Or maybe the I'll have to give that some thought. That's fascinating. Here's a question. What you do is very much dependent on what you have with you. If you have nothing, I'd like to kind of approach this from two perspectives. One is if you find yourself lost and you have, let's say, a minimum of gear. You have maybe matches. You have or a lighter. You have some sort of protective clothing. Maybe you have a flashlight or something. So you have at least some protection. And the other would be if you find yourself with nothing, because there's. For example, if you have a tent, you could just hunker in and say, I'm going to stay right here until someone finds me, because eventually they will. Very likely they would. But if you don't have anything, then you have other concerns, which has to do with your own survival. Why don't you help us understand the differences there, or maybe there aren't that many differences.
Well, there are. I think the first thing to understand is once you realize you're lost, and whether that's that sudden realization or that creeping realization, there's an acronym, STOP, which stands for, literally, stop, think, observe, and plan. By following that acronym, it can sort of focus your mind, prevent panic from creeping in, which is the worst thing that can happen, because then you're going to make serious bad decisions that can complicate things. You've got to stop, you've got to think, which way did I come from? Which way was the trail supposed to have gone? You've got to observe. Which way, given the time of day, where's the sun? Which is going to give you an idea of which direction is which. You know, in the summertime at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, the sun's going to be over in the west to southwest side. After observing your situation, which includes where you are situated physically, are you on a ridgetop, or are you on a valley floor, or are you next to flowing water? You've got to then plan. You've got to plan how you're going to take care of yourself for the next several hours, or perhaps a day or two. If you've got some minimal things with you, they're going to make your grand adventure a lot more, I suppose, comfortable is a good name. There's something that in search and rescue and in the mountaineering clubs, the Appalachian Mountain Club, the Colorado Mountain Club, the Mountaineers have all talked about for many years, and it's called the 10 Essentials. And that's the 10 minimum things you should carry whenever you go into the backcountry. And that could be for a day hike, it could be for a 1 hour mountain bike ride, it doesn't matter. Anytime you're away from immediate help, you want to have these things with you so that when you twist an ankle, whether hiking, whether you're on a mountain bike, whether you're skiing, but you're several miles in and you cannot get out because you can't walk, you've got to have these things take care of you. And I'll run through them real quickly.
Sure.
Those 10 essentials are obviously, perhaps not obviously, a first aid kit. That's something you really need to know how to use the stuff in it before the emergency hits. If you're in a semi-panic mindset, it's going to be very difficult to use that first aid kit. A map and a compass. And I'd say a map and a compass, and I include that in addition to perhaps a GPS that you might be carrying. Again, if you're in thick vegetation, the radio signal might not be able to penetrate. You may not be able to get a signal, especially if you've got one of the slightly older GPSs that do not have a map in it. All it gives you is a digital readout, perhaps an arrow for direction of travel. There's no map that you can follow on it. A pocket knife. That's a multi-purpose tool that can be used for lots of different things. Matches and a fire starter. Waterproof matches and a fire starter. Fire starter could be something that you build from scratch, or it could be a little stick that you buy in a camping store that burns when you light it. Some sort of a impromptu shelter. And that can be something as simple as a very large garbage bag, or a tube tent, or a space blanket. A flashlight for when it gets dark, and it's going to get dark. Emergency clothing for both the temperature and rain. That's going to vary greatly in your climate. Here in Colorado, you don't have to worry about rain too much. As a matter of fact, we never get enough rain. But in the eastern part of the country, it's going to rain. In the desert southwest, it's not going to rain, but it's still going to get darn cold at night. So you've got to have some warm clothing. Include along with that some emergency food and some emergency water. When I'm teaching kids these 10 essentials, I tell them, emergency food is the stuff that's left over after you gobbled up everything you already wanted to eat during the day. So make it something that maybe isn't that great to taste. If your emergency food is nothing but Snickers bars, kids are going to eat them through the day. They'll have nothing left. Folks in search and rescue teams, they carry emergency food. Some of that stuff's been in their pack for a couple of years. They've got to be really hungry to eat something that's been in their pack drying out for 2 years. The last thing is really important at altitude when you're talking about snow, and that's sunglasses so that you don't get your eyes sunburned. And actually, there's an 11th essential that I learned from a sixth grader when I was teaching this class several years ago at an elementary school here in Evergreen, Colorado. And he said, the most important of the 10 essentials is a companion. And I kind of slapped my head and thought, boy, that's absolutely remarkably smart thinking. It's the old two heads are better than one. If I get in trouble, there's someone there to help me out. If you're not carrying the 10 essentials, you can still get through this situation. It's not going to be quite as comfortable. The important things are, again, you've got to stop, and you've got to stop early. Because you may have to find or build an impromptu shelter. And you want to do that before it's dark. Moving around in the dark in unfamiliar terrain, you may not be able to find or build shelter. And obviously, unless there's a pretty good moon, you may not be able to see where you're going. The least risk is sliding on a wet log and tripping an ankle. The worst risk is falling over the brink of something and injuring yourself. And I don't mean falling over a 1,000-foot cliff. I mean falling over maybe an 8-foot cliff.
If anybody's been out in the woods when it's pitch black, you cannot see anything. You can't see a stick 2 inches in front of your face. There's nothing. You're really extremely vulnerable. It's scary. It's a scary situation. I've been in those situations just kind of walking back after a hike through areas that I've been familiar with, but found myself in a pitch black night. And I'm telling you, that is a most unusual reality.
It really, really is. And there's nothing quite that dark, is there?
No, you literally feel your way every inch, you know. So the problem there is such an increased capacity for injuring yourself. And I know, for example, when I'm camping, I never like to put up after dark. Never. I always make every effort to be sure, even when I'm have my tents and my gear, to get in before dark and get that tent set up, because you just have so much greater opportunity to do it right.
Absolutely. when you're forced to make camp in the dark, you're always surprised in the morning.
Yes.
The spot you picked, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, how in the world could I put this thing here? Yeah. We've covered some background and the 11 essentials, but there's more to this story. Next, we explore your options when you face the unknowns of being lost. As we continue this lesson in survival, when your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.